I have Lauren Bell with me here. We are sitting in Totem Park. It's a little bit of, I guess it's a west wind, mm-hmm. a little bit of west breeze. Onshore flow keeping, well, it was forecast to be a sunny day today, but it is not.
Yes.
It was this morning. I don't know if you were up early enough. Yeah. I happened to be up early enough this morning, and it was like blue skies and sunny. And then I looked out to the west, and I saw just kind of the clouds over the trees, and I thought, well, maybe this fog's burning off. But no, 15, 20 minutes later, psh,
yep, it's all the way over. Temperature just dropped dramatically.
Chilly, quite chilly. And I could see, this would be one of those days, like the road up Harbor Mountain is no doubt still closed due to snow, but mm-hmm. like, it's always fun to get up high above the marine stratus layer and see the clouds below you.
But, oh, I'm sure it's beautiful up there.
Yeah, wasn't it? I imagine there are some folks that went up there in their ATVs, but yeah, I'm not quite that ambitious mm-hmm. to walk up there today. But yeah, it's been a while. I think this is maybe your third or fourth time uh-huh. for the show, and
so.
And I thought it'd be fun to talk to you about your ongoing research. Mm-hmm. I just talked to your, I guess, I don't know if you really call you classmates. You're in the same department. Taylor, I talked to a little earlier this year. She's wrapping up her abalone work, and mm-hmm. I saw there was an article in the paper about abalone mm-hmm. harvesting, and it seemed like there were a lot of people out this weekend, or this past weekend on the low tide series.
Yeah.
And so are you, you know, it's quarantine time, and you're doing your work, sounds like, in kind of a middle zone between research project bits, and but in Sitka for the quarantine, which maybe is better than California. Really, kind of was like, whoosh,
oh yeah, I was happy. I was supposed to go down to California to teach marine botany, so about seaweeds this quarter to undergraduates at UC Santa Cruz, and I'm kind of grateful in some respects that I learned before I left that I needed to stay here and got to spend this spring here in Sitka. And it's been interesting transitioning that course to an online format, but we're doing it.
So you were doing marine botany,
mm-hmm.
and so, yeah, so marine botany which is a field course
yep.
for that school.
Yes,
is a little awkward when you're not together in the field.
Correct.
And in fact, people don't live by the ocean in some cases.
Correct. They're all back in their own home areas, which in most for the most of them, way away from the coast.
Oh well, yep. that does seem a little awkward. Do you send them materials at all, or is it?
Well, we're doing a lot of meeting over Zoom, mm-hmm. and I'm creating virtual field trips where I go out at low tides here in Sitka Sound and introduce them to all my favorite algae and seagrasses. So that's what's covered under marine botany. We have the algae, the seaweeds, and then seagrasses, so the marine plants.
Yeah.
And yeah, we trying to make field trips for them. We do cross sections for them of different algae, show them how to identify them. I work through the key with them taxonomically. So
I suppose in some ways it's more work on you to do things that I may as good practice maybe, but
yeah, but they're getting, I mean, they all recognize the situation and yeah. everyone's going with the flow. So it's been fun and fun challenge.
Yeah. Well, it is. And we've had some nice low tides assisted by high pressures that I think are, but I guess that was April, the beginning of April tide ended up being a -3.7, I mm-hmm. think, which might end up being the lowest tide of the year.
Yeah.
So predicted to be a -3.3, I think. And then, yeah, it's been interesting to kind of track the way that the tides work over the years. And,
yeah.
I mean, I was aware that low tides were in the mornings because that's when we always had sea week in school when mm-hmm. I was growing up. I imagine, yeah, I mean, you're from Homer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine the tides there, the timing is probably a little different, like mm-hmm. your lowest tides of the cycle in the summertime. Are they later in the day or are they earlier than here?
I think that...
I can't remember which way the tides go around.
Yeah.
So. But they kind of move around the coast, I guess,
yeah.
Which I didn't realize until recent years. It's just like, it's weird. Growing up on the coast, you just sort of take them for granted. You know
totally.
About the tides.
Totally.
But like looking at those broader patterns isn't something that I did until more recently.
Mm-hmm.
But my son has been very into intertidal stuff lately.
Okay.
And so he's been like, I want to go out for the tides this week, and it's supposed to be nice weather, so they'll probably even be lower,
which
isn't always the case, but it has been recently. So,
yeah,
yeah, there's some nice tides to get out and see,
yeah.
and of course, the springtime seems to be the best time for diversity. I mean, there's stuff year-round, I guess. And
well, especially for seaweeds, which is now
seaweeds, yeah.
kind of what my attention is drawn to. And I think it's interesting as I've grown through my, you know, childhood on the ocean and now my, I guess, career that has blossomed as a marine biologist, where your attention is focused in the intertidal shifts so much over
yeah.
time. And for me, it's shifted, you know, with every different group that I've become interested in. I think as a younger person, I was always looking at, you know, the big conspicuous things, the anemones and the sea stars and, you know, some of the bigger things. And then as I went through college, I loved all the invertebrates. They became the thing that I wanted to look at and look for diversity on. And now I finally transitioned to the seaweeds. And, oh, man, springtime here for seaweeds is like... It's incredible. Yeah. It's overwhelming.
Right. Yes, that it is. I remember that. Yeah, I guess when we talked previously about your master's project, that was all invertebrates.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and,
correct.
And we talked a little bit about your diving and looking at the walls of invertebrates. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they live in a... They got to eat something, I guess.
Yes.
And they eat each other and they eat seaweed, I suppose.
Correct.
Yep. How a lot of it goes.
Yep. The base of the food web.
Yeah. And it is. Seaweeds are... It's an interesting experience for me because I've looked at a lot of different groups over mm-hmm. the years, and the marine kind of intertidal one is one of the later ones for me. Like, I was aware of it and I looked at stuff, but I haven't really tried to sort of, the way I might describe it is make sense of things.
Sure.
Just to be able to start, because part of the problem is sometimes there's not even a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of number of different things, but you just look at it and you're... Because you don't know what anything is, it's hard to make sense of.
Yeah, it kind of blends into the background.
Right, it's just all kind of this big mash,
yep.
and you don't even know how to begin to sort it in terms of what you're looking to add and attending to.
Yes.
And I kind of have had that feeling with marine stuff. And so, you know, my tendency has been to look for the obvious things that are unmistakable, like your sea anemones. Not that there aren't difficult ID problems in sea anemones,
sure.
but I know what a sea anemone is,
yes.
and I know what crabs are.
Yes.
And, you know, so we start with those kind of things. And then the seaweeds, I like the little halosakians that you
uh-huh.
can...
Oh,
the
yeah.
little, those ones are one I remember. There's a few things I remember specifically from being a kid, and that's one of them.
Yes.
You know, squirting
you can
each other
squirt
with
squirt your
those.
Friends, yep.
Yeah.
And the fucus, the,
yeah.
the rockweed,
oh, right,
popweed,
the popweed
can do the
yeah.
same, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so there's a few of those that are like pretty straightforward and, mm-hmm. and easy enough. But yeah, then it's I mean, I guess diversity wise, there's 200 or 300 probably species that mm-hmm. could occur on this coast.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly less than California or,
yeah.
you know, further south. But we still get quite
just
a bit.
Plenty.
I mean, again,
yeah.
these low tides, you go, wow, there's so many that I didn't realize. And you get down close and you go, that little red is so different than the other red. And
yeah. yeah. It is... Maybe I'll pause here for a moment
yep.
and let our helicopter go by.
Yes.
it's always a little hard to tell how loud the helicopter's going to
yeah.
be in the
not
recording.
Necessarily a pleasant add-on to...
No.
As they circle around us.
But, yeah, it... when I recorded with... Oh, I forgot to set the time when we started, too.
Oh.
I don't know how long
you said you
going.
Would.
Yeah, I was like, I need to remember to do that. So I'm going to... start the clock here. I think we talked for like maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That seemed reasonable. The little things that we can squirt.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is interesting, the those things that you remember from being a kid that stand out. But yeah, as you're saying, the diversity you get down here, and mm-hmm. some of them are, I mean, there's a lot of seaweeds that are pretty big. I don't
mm-hmm.
know. There's probably some that are just microscopic.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I suppose at some point you're getting into plankton at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're mostly focused on macroalgae?
Macroalgae, yep. And most of my work is subtitle.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of my work diving, scuba diving, and interested in kind of those communities that are associated with the giant kelp forests, so
mm-hmm.
the Macrocystis beds, and all the different macroalgae that exist within those beds, because that kind of, you can imagine, creates its own little... ecosystem with the shading from above, the wave attenuation that happens because of those big Macrocystis that are up in the water column. So you get these really beautiful sub-canopies of other kinds of kelp, and then turf algae, and then the crustose calcium-containing algae
mm-hmm.
that's down below.
So there's, yeah, I mean, I guess I've seen epiphytes on the, there's things that grow, I guess, specialize really on growing on other seaweeds.
Yeah.
And then the seagrasses. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing subtitle, is that including seagrasses for your
there's
subtitle?
Not much,
is there's
no,
not enough?
No, they're more shallow than
yeah, they're pretty
than I really
shallow.
Get. Yeah.
So what's the kind of the shallowest that you're working
the
at?
The surveys that I do are 15 feet is the mm-hmm. shallowest for mean lower low water. So we get sometimes the codiums that you'll see,
mm-hmm.
the green algae that are unicellular but are huge.
The big cushions?
Yeah,
or are those
the
big, all just one
they're
cell?
One cell.
Oh,
they're siphonous in single cells.
Wow.
Really cool.
Yeah. Well, that's a cell, I guess you can see with the naked eye.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So we get some of those that creep down. Alaria, a lot of people eat Alaria around here.
Yeah.
I think the ribbon kelp, if that's what
right.
it's called.
Right, I don't remember all the common names, but yeah.
Yeah, and so we get some of those, but mostly it's the big saccharine. So some of the canopy, sub-canopy kelps that get really big throughout the spring. So some of the saccharinas, that name has recently changed,
right.
And agarums, and yeah, and you know, it is kind of cool to study these species because not a lot of work has been done on just their basic ecology. So some of the stuff I get to do, I think, is really fun. Like, I get to go out and put tags, number tags on these different individuals. I'll punch a hole in them, the kind of the classic, let's study the growth of this this algae. And they grow from where their stipe, what you could kind of imagine is like a stem on on a plant, regular plant, where the stipe hits the blade.
So they grow from the bottom, basically.
So they grow from the bottom. It's called the intercalary meristem. So if you punch a hole in the blade just forward of that, and you know how far that distance is, you can return to that same individual and see how far has it grown every month or every couple weeks.
Hmm.
And so you can get a really neat growth curve throughout the year as the sunlight changes, as the nutrients change. And some of these guys, I mean, they're growing like 20 centimeters, 25 centimeters a month.
Wow.
Putting on a lot of biomass.
So that's like a centimeter a day almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed in this time of year, especially actually a little earlier, probably starting in March, that seaweeds are like the bigger brown blades, the kelps are washing up on the beach here at the park, and it's like, oh, somebody picked the wrong rock, because it's just a like a fist sized rock
totally.
And this 3 foot long blade, and you're like, ah, oh, that's why that washed up.
Yep,
it didn't take much, you know, wave action for that to sort of dislodge and then just get pushed up the shoreline.
Yep.
And I imagine that was originally starting basically at the very lowest intertidal or subtidal. And just not really a good anchor.
Right, and finally the winter storm picked up quite enough that,
Well, and that's, it seems like, and I wondered about, because I, maybe it was just because I wasn't coming down here in the winter that I wasn't seeing them, but I tended to associate it with kind of the springtime.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if, like, one of my curiosities about it was it just that they had been small, and then they had a growth spurt, essentially, that they now had enough of a profile
increased
in the
drag.
Water that essentially...
It's
that
probably a balance there, right? Like the increased wind in the wintertime and then also that surface area that's causing more drag. And
And I wasn't sure, like, their growth cycle. So, like, it sounds like they can grow pretty fast when they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, I guess, when the daylight increases and the water's still clear, maybe that's their optimal growth time?
It depends on the species. Yeah, it's really interesting. Some of them maximize growth, like, January, February. They
really, really boost.
Because there's just becoming enough light, but the nutrients are really high at that point.
Mm.
If they wait through March, April, you get the big phytoplankton blooms, and all of a sudden nutrients just bottom out.
I see.
So some of them maximize growth then. Other ones kind of do low level throughout the year. So it's pretty different strategies, you know, for where they want to dominate the canopy at what time.
So the Macrocystis, the big giant kelps, they form the forest, essentially.
Yeah.
I suppose, I mean, does a Narrocystis, the bull kelp, does that... Do people consider that a kelp forest as well? I mean, we don't
kelp
seem
forest,
to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that
I think
it doesn't
forest,
seem to be as much. Yeah,
I think the forest term is more applied to giant kelp just because it's such a so much biomass in the water column. But people call Narrocystis the bull kelp beds because they do congregate in some area that has favorable substrate for them.
Right. It seems like, I mean, I have seen large masses of them, but... and I can't. I know this is a question that came up around sea otters coming back, and sort of the impact of them on herbivores, which in turn then had the impact on the kelp, and whether or not the bull kelp was had an advantage, relatively speaking, as an annual, to grow in places under. Herbivory, I guess, under grazing pressure, whereas Macrocystis as a perennial has an advantage if it isn't getting eaten all the time.
Yep.
Especially from the base, I guess that'd be kind of a bummer when they're growing that tall. So I don't know if there's any, like, were you looking into that at one point?
It's just in my studies of the ecology in general.
Just in general,
But, I mean, those dynamics are so interesting. And there's, of course, all these different camps about what's controlling Macrocystis range extent, because we really butt up against the furthest north continuous distribution of giant kelp here at the top of Southeast Alaska. There's a few beds that they found in Kodiak and some in Prince William Sound, but doesn't really seem like they're persistent over time. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interest in, okay, what's going on there? Is it light? Is it temperature? Is it, you know, what is it? And now there's a lot more interest because they've seen big die-offs of kelp beds down mm-hmm. south, and there's a lot of concern about that. The big theory is that we had those big warm years.
Right. That the warm blob things,
really,
yeah.
Really warm, that probably stressed the kelp out. It went beyond their thermal threshold. And then with sea star wasting that knocked out all those big sunflower stars, big urchin blooms, and those are just mowing down the kelp. And
right.
so you're seeing huge transitions in Monterey to kelp, to urchin barrens. And so there's a lot of interest in, oh my God, even some proposals of we should go out and hire people and take out all the urchins. But I found it interesting to follow kind of the debate around this, because I've also been to conferences where folks have said, you know, yes, there's some environmental control that's happened, but at the same time, if we look at satellite data over a 40-year period of kelp dynamics, the bottom line is they're super patchy. I mean, they come yeah. and go, and they fluctuate so much every couple of years. And if you look at only a 5-year period, it's going to look different than the dynamics on a 10-year period, on a 20-year period. But if you look at a 35-year period, the slope is like zero. It's
yeah.
just in terms of total biomass, they just come and go. So interesting dynamics that are
yeah.
going on.
Well, that's one of those things that it's, I try to regularly remind myself that my window of time is pretty narrow.
Yeah.
And the window of time I've been paying attention even more narrow.
Yep.
And it's easy. I've had plenty of reminders that things that seemed new to me actually have been around the whole time.
Sure,
I just
sure.
didn't notice. So, you know, in scientific endeavors where you have data,
yeah.
that's a helpful way to compare, you know, when it's just impressions. And so, you know,
yeah.
you get things from people that are like, oh, you know, it used to be this way or that way. And I'm like, well, maybe. But
yep.
maybe, or it didn't used to be. That's often the case. I never saw this before.
Yes.
And that might be true. But that doesn't mean it wasn't here always either. And that's just like knowing my own experience of never having seen things that turned out to always have been here or been here as long as I have been. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But I can't really go much further
yeah.
than that. So it is nice when you have like the satellite record, if that's sufficient resolution to start looking at
yes,
that. And,
yes.
And these, yeah, the you know, a career in science is probably, you know, long career is probably 30 to 40 years.
Right.
And you know, many people working have not been working nearly that long.
Yes. Well,
so,
and they talk about it as a major issue with graduate student tracks because a lot of graduate students are pressured into making these grand conclusions
oh, yeah.
from their, you know, 4 years, 3 or 4 years of data that they collect.
That's
of
tough.
A trend.
Yeah.
And, you know, come on, what are you really able to say? In terms of, you know, long-term dynamics.
Right.
So just being very careful about what you're...
right.
how you're interpreting things over that period.
Well, I've wondered about that, and I wondered about the, like, the breakwaters that come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if I might have asked you about this. I think I asked somebody about it. Just the equivalent of turnover, blowdown, you know,
mm-hmm.
or something. I suppose storms could rip up patches,
mm-hmm.
But it's in terrestrial ecosystems. You know, you have wind throw mm-hmm. or fire down south,
mm-hmm.
and mudslides, things that impact the and reset at some level,
yep.
kind of create fresh new ground. And I mean, clearly there could be a slide in the ocean, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah.
The breakwaters are an obvious place where a lot of habitat was created in some cases or you know, reset in others if they just covered up old stuff. And I did notice when they put in the breakwater out at the north end of the channel that the first year it looked like there was a lot of green algae on it, but not much browner stuff, and then mm-hmm. and then it was browner, and then I can't remember now because they filled in, there was the breakwater had been there a while and they filled in that part, and I can't remember, I haven't looked recently because John Brown's beach has been closed, but if it now looks more uniform and you can't tell the new from the old based on the seaweed at low tide.
Oh, yeah.
But for a while you definitely could. And I assumed that there's some pattern of succession.
Oh, yeah. There's succession dynamics are just the same
yeah.
in the ocean. And, you know, even the things that you think about, well, maybe the ocean's different because dispersal is probably so much greater. with, you know, algal spores. They've done studies to show, you know, a Macrocystis that has all of its sporophylls, where the reproductive structures that reduce spores are right at the base, right at the top of the holdfast. And they thought, oh, okay, well, maybe those release and they go off, way off, and distribute, you know, far and wide. No, like 99% of the spores land within like half a meter of the parent plant. So, yeah, it's not quite as...
Well, I mean, obviously they get somewhere somehow, but...
Yes. There are some.
But it's a rare thing, yep. Yeah.
And there are big... I think one of the big thoughts is that the... when entire plants pull up in storms and those float and then they release spores, that's another big vector for dispersal.
So they're, I mean, they're not like a plant where you pull them up and they're dead.
Correct.
They don't, the holdfast isn't roots. Mm-hmm. So they're alive until they're not, I guess.
Correct.
But what is it that's killing? I mean, when they wash ashore and they don't have water, I imagine that they're
so
dying,
this
right?
is why algae are so cool, because they, unlike plants, they don't have specialized structures. The big kelps have some ability to transport throughout the different parts of their thallus, the entire individual. But all parts of them can photosynthesize. All parts of them can take up nutrients. So you're right that when they get pulled up, that's not necessarily going to kill them. But if they, you know, around here, if they float to the surface and there's a huge freshwater lens, they're probably not going to like that. If they wash up on shore and they get sunbaked and dehydrated, then they're not gonna like that. So,
I mean, they do float out there for a while. And I guess, I guess that makes sense as a dispersal mechanism. You get out, especially if you get into a current out into the Gulf and like there's nothing out there. I guess there's nutrients out for them. There's nutrients out there, and they're just drifting around.
Yeah, but you'll find, I mean, I've seen, when I've been on the outer coast, I've seen big rafts of macrocystis that have been pulled up and floating out there, and it looks pretty healthy. Because even, you know, those are so light adapted, you know, they can handle being up at the surface waters and just getting hit by light as long as they stay wet. So they can be healthy, and you can still eat them while they're out there. And
well, I suppose there's probably a whole... community that essentially is associated with that kind of you know, some of them are just things that happen to go along for the ride, not necessarily because they wanted to, but they happen to be there and at the wrong time at the right place.
Yeah, sad little turbid snails all the way out there.
But the but the maybe there's other things, fish and so forth, that as they get out there, like that's there's food and and shelter essentially that maybe they're taking advantage of. I don't know if I imagine somebody's probably looked at that a little bit, but
there are cool papers that look at rafts and like all the fish. I think it's more, you see it more in tropical areas, but whole schools of fish that congregate around algal rafts. And
I mean, I guess it was the Sargasso Sea is like, that's the seaweed that's out there. And I mean, that's its whole life cycle is essentially as a drifting. Do we have drifting seaweeds in Alaska that's kind of their thing, or is they pretty much all?
No, nope. They might have, mostly they're just getting caught up.
Well, so here's another question that I don't know if you know the answer to, but I've wondered for a long time. The seaweeds, you know, there's quite a few seaweeds that are basically ephemeral. You see them for, you know, there's the small green blade, the praziola, that's like it's starting to green up in December, actually, and grow in December. And it seems to be kind of biggest in April. And then it dries up pretty good in May and June. And actually, there's some... well, they used to all be porphyrias, but now they're pyropias and various things.
All the black seaweeds.
Yeah, the black pyropia. Seaweeds, right, right. And those also seem to be, you know, in some cases, like people say, well, there's you got like a week to go gather that one that you really like. And there's quite a few different species of those, you know, something that's been traditionally harvested for a long time. And there's a very particularity about which ones are okay to eat. Some people are less discriminating than others about which ones are good. But
and you have to be able to tell them apart.
Right,
a lot of those pyropia, the...
They're
hard
tough.
To tell.
I mean, if you want to be like technical and taxonomic about it, they seem to be quite tough. if you know what you like taste wise and texture wise, it maybe you just know where to get it. And you've been taught, or you've figured it out. So, but they seem to be in completely ephemeral. Like they're just there is. I don't know. So are they like its little cluster of cells just attached to the rock at kind of a microscopic level year-round that they're kind of in a dormant phase?
Yeah, so there's, for a lot of the seaweeds, they are either, they have two stages of their life history, or for a lot of the reds, they actually are triphasic. nice and complicated. But for a lot of algae, including the big kelps, half of their life cycle is as a microscopic form. And for some that's the haploid phase, for some it's the diploid phase. It totally depends, but yeah, they it depends on.
So are they?
No worries.
Hello. So are they actually metabolically active in that microscopic phase? They're I mean, it's weird to think about they're growing, but I guess they could be growing at that point.
Yeah, and some will continue to grow kind of right through it, and others will be dormant and wait for good conditions, and
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because I imagined, like, the green ones that are, they're really high in the intertidal. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, like, barely intertidal at all in some respects.
And those Preciola are cool because they can handle a ton of fresh water.
Yeah, they seem to, I mean, they, like, froze.
Yeah.
There was fresh water, just ice all over them. Yeah. In some years when we get those March, they just seem to be fine.
Oh, yeah.
So it is, yeah, it's kind of, it's an interesting thing. And I know mosses, for example, have the two different phases and like the sporophyte. It just looks like it's a fruiting body of the plant, but it's actually a different phase. Mm-hmm. Ferns do the same thing. And I don't quite fully understand these life cycle things. And so seaweeds, you know, so there's the crust, the what is it, the tar spot fungus or not fungus, tar spot algae is like a mastocarpus or something. And if I remember correctly, reading in the Seaweeds of Lhasa book, that can be like there for 100 years or something like that.
And it's just it's like just almost crustose on the rock. You wouldn't even really know. It just looks like someone spilled paint.
Doesn't do anything. Nothing grows from it. It just, but then is it releasing things every once in a while, or is that basically what's going on?
And then it will become its upright phase, and you'll actually
will it
have
grow from the spot, or does that send out and then anchor down?
Yeah, see, this is me remembering every life stage memory. The reds especially are difficult because they they just have so many different types. But I think that they will send out either their gametes or their spores, depending on if that was the gametophyte or the sporophyte or the tetrasporophyte for reds.
and maybe we've been talking about reds and greens and kelps and stuff. So there's you know, for many of us, I guess, it's like seaweeds. And, they're different colors. And it isn't really all about color, because there's plenty of red seaweeds that look very brown.
Correct.
or even black in some cases. And plenty of brown seaweeds that look yellow or fairly pale. But they're like major groups.
Yep.
So the green seaweeds, if I'm remembering correctly, are they're in a broader group that includes like the plants.
The chlorophyta,
And then the red algaes is kind of their own thing. And then the brown algaes are their they're related to diatoms and other kind of little things like that. But so seaweed is, I guess, like they say about plankton, seaweed's more of a lifestyle than it is a taxonomic group.
Yeah. I mean, and you can still differentiate those three big groups. And a lot of them, it comes down to, you know, how many flagella do their spores have? And,
oh, wow.
and what are their main pigments and all of that. And, you know, some of the early theories were, you see where they are in the intertidal or the subtidal based on, you know, what part of the light spectrum they are harvesting, and they arrange themselves in that way. It's not quite that simple.
Yeah.
You know, there's species across all groups.
Convergent evolution sorts of things.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, it is. I mean, it is, unfortunately, like for somebody that wants to post things on iNaturalist, and you're supposed to get a group, essentially the common group for all of them is life.
Yeah,
And so you can't really, so you're kind of guessing. Over time, I've mostly, green ones are they're green.
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah.
There's some that are really dark green, but they're green.
Yep.
The reds and the browns, some of them are quite simple. I mean, the kelps are pretty straightforward, but some of the other reds and browns are you just have to know.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have known. The little pine, you know, what do they call them?
Near rhodomella?
Yeah.
Yep.
Black pine, I think they call it.
Yep.
It's a common
name.
The world
ones.
It's like a dark brown.
Yes.
You would not at all expect that to be
red.
But
if in doubt, it's probably a red.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. That seems to be the most diverse group around here. I don't know if that's true elsewhere, but it seems like the most diversity and most challenges in ID.
Yeah. Most diversity, but up here, if you're talking about biomass, then it usually comes down to the browns.
And that's the kelps, basically.
That's the kelps,
Macrocystis, Nereocystis, and then all the simpler blades, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for lack of a better better way to describe them. They seem to be mostly just anchored with sometimes a blade that fragments, but they don't seem to have those long stipes that the bull kelp and the macrocystis.
They're not reaching all the way to the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and those are all part of, so you were talking about, so you're looking at the kelp forest, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there's the canopy layer, I guess. So are you looking at it in terms of from surface to the bottom?
Uh-huh. So we do seasonal surveys, the team that I work with. We go out in winter and in summer and do a whole bunch of diving in both seasons. A lot more pleasant in the summertime.
Yeah, a little more visibility in the winter, yeah. but
yeah.
a lot
visibility
more cold.
It's more beautiful underwater in the winter, but whew, it can be cold. And we do full community surveys. The surveys we do also include fish and invertebrates, but mm-hmm. the part I'm interested in is trying to capture all the algal diversity. So we go through, and for the giant kelp, I do stipe counts. You know, I come to each individual, I look at the holdfast, I go up a meter, and I count how many stipes there are. I've done pull downs where I pull down the entire canopy from the surface to estimate how long it is. Mm. And then the understory, the subcanopy kelps, go through and we measure the blades to get a sense of biomass. We count each one. We separate them by species. And then for any of the species that aren't, you know, stipitate, they don't have one single identifiable stem.
Yeah.
We actually do percent cover. So I take down a whole quadrat, I lay it down, and I identify species. And then I say, okay, well, that amount of encrusting coral and algae covers 25% of this, and that turf algae covers this much, and so trying to get a sense of biomass and coverage that way.
These are kind of overlapping though, aren't they? I mean, so you don't expect your percentages to add up to 100, I guess.
Correct. Because they're all different heights and everything,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, like, they're even growing on top of each other
yep.
sometimes.
Yeah, they come like, out so. Of each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not... It's not straightforward,
right?
but it's neat. It's neat to see, and I mean, for people who've been out there and have noticed seasonal changes, you can imagine. I mean, really big differences winter to summer in just biomass and what's there and how healthy it looks. Mm-hmm. A lot of the algae that you see, including the giant kelp in certain areas, by the end of the summer starts to look pretty ratty.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've noticed going out in the fall that it's like. And then it looks really ratty in the winter when it's been beat up after the storms, you know, the fall storms but so it's, so the macrocystis then, it just keeps growing from near the base.
It also has it has intercalary.
Oh, so
meristem,
it can grow from the middle too?
So it's growing everywhere. The pneumatocyst, that bulb, mm-hmm. connects with a blade. It's growing out from there. And then it has, if you ever have a chance to go look at the end of a macrocystis stipe growing end, it's called a scimitar blade. I think it sounds like some sci-fi weapon of choice.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. It's all of these little, the air-filled pneumatocyst bulbs are starting to pull away, and it's growing from that apical meristem. So it's extending mm-hmm. and elongating from there.
It's growing from all different parts.
Yes.
Then. Does it keep growing after it? So I guess that we talked about it's still alive. It's still growing when they're in those rafts out?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone's looked at that. I imagine if it's getting the right nutrients and everything it could,
I don't, I mean, I guess, because they're usually in a big tangle, so I don't know if it ends up creating a sort of a paucity of nutrients in the water, whereas being spread out would make it a little easier. Mm-hmm. But I guess, it hadn't occurred to me that it's like, I'm just so anchored in if you get cut up, you're not alive anymore.
Right. the algae can handle it. Yeah.
They won't regrow an anchor or anything if they...
No, they can't regrow. They need the initial holdfast.
So that's that kind of gets them started.
Yeah.
And, I mean, those can get pretty massive, those
huge.
Fasts.
And you'll see them washed up on the beach.
Right.
And they're their own ecosystem, right? Like, you'll just see all the isopods and brittle stars that are in there and crabs and... Yeah, a lot of things.
So are you looking at all at the sort of the faunal assemblages in your...
It's part of our community surveys. Mm-hmm. For my particular dissertation work, I'm conveniently avoiding that, that aspect. But
that's a whole other complicating...
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, that is the main recognition, is that they are big habitat generators. They're mm-hmm. called, they're considered foundational species because they create this complex habitat for different species.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is, I suppose it's one of those, pretty much anywhere in the natural world, you know, you could spend a lifetime really kind of getting to know how things are working. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of complexity there, and made more difficult by the challenge that we're not so good underwater.
Right, yes. We have a limited window.
Right, awkward at best and with a very limited window.
And that's the most frustrating thing about it is, you know, we have this an hour mm-hmm. per dive to get as much done as we can, and... before we really get cold enough or have to use the bathroom enough that we really have to call it. That's the problem with dry suits. You have to go up to the surface to take care of yourself. And so, it's It's limited, but...
Is the water temperature that different? I mean, it's a little... I mean, you mentioned that it's really cold in the winter, but it seems like the ocean temperature isn't really that much different.
It changes quite a bit. Yeah, it goes from
10 degrees or more.
It's about 8 degrees Celsius change. So it goes.
Oh yeah, so that's.
So it goes from 7 degrees Celsius, 6 or 7 degrees Celsius in the winter, which is chilly. Around 43 Fahrenheit. Up to, we dive in 15 degrees Celsius sometimes in the kelp forest here. So
even down to the. I'm like, how is the temperature profile?
You know, so all of our dives are in giant kelp forests, which here only extend down to about 35 feet at max. Mm-hmm. So it can be, it's like maybe 14 degrees Celsius. So like 55, 56 Fahrenheit.
Oh, that's
which makes a difference.
I bet.
In the summertime, you can actually dive in a wetsuit and stay down.
I guess I could put on my Newton's law of cooling thing to math hat to calculate your energy flux.
I will not wear gloves occasionally because it's so much easier to take notes and everything without wearing neoprene gloves. But you do encounter a really distinct thermocline in the summertime, which is really interesting to pass through. Where really beautiful sun-warmed surface waters, and then you go
a little
chilly. Just descend right below it, and usually you'll have kind of a difference in clarity as well.
So yeah,
it's pretty interesting.
Is it more clear down below?
It can be more clear.
Yeah, I guess there's the filtered light. I mean, it's getting darker because the light, but the actual water.
And usually those colder waters are a little more clear.
Hmm.
Just in general, but yeah, it's. It's interesting to look at.
Yeah, it seems like it would be. And are you having, I guess, you know, sometimes I'm just thinking like trail cams. Is there an underwater equivalent of trail cams that you, you know, I don't know what that would be useful for in the end, but other than curiosity of seeing what's swimming by.
Yeah, kind of right. No, I take cameras down there with me every time just because. Mm-hmm. Anytime I don't take a camera with me, a sea lion comes and plays in front of me or something like that. So I've set up, you know, time lapse as much as I can over time. But I'm not sure what people have done. And besides seeing movement over time. Oh, actually, you know, when I was doing my master's, I did a project where I was interested in sunflower stars and how they dug holes to dig out clams. Because there was a lot of interest in whether... predation for butter clams in Ketchmack Bay was mostly caused by sunflower stars or by otters coming in.
Oh, yeah.
So we set up, basically buried a clam as bait and then set up a GoPro to do a time lapse on a little stand near it and watched to see if any sea stars would come and dig it up and how they dug it up and then compared those holes, the depressions that were left to sea otter holes, interesting. Yeah, they came and dug out, and they look like little... They sweep kind of around and then pull up the clam. And
interesting.
The bottom line was that it's pretty difficult to tell the difference between those two predators.
Yeah, I bet. Well, the water tends to smooth things out a bit, I guess.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Things settle in. But that's interesting. I guess the other thing would be is if it were in a growing season, you'd do it in time lapse over a... a month or something. I don't know. Battery life might be a bit of a challenge in that temperature, but just like seeing the growth rate of the changes in like the bottom or something happening.
Yeah,
but anchoring that kind of stuff is probably supposed to get a little challenging.
I like
as
the
well.
Hole punch method.
Yeah, that makes sense for how fast things are growing for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
I was kind of thinking in terms of. The cover.
Oh,
the way that I don't know how much the low. Ground cover equivalent, you know.
The turfs,
all right. So the turfs, are they, you know, expanding and contracting seasonally, or they tend to, like, uniformly grow, or...
Yeah, I think they grow until they meet some competition resistance. With other, or grazers come by and mow them down. As far as I know, their growth rates aren't, you know, they're not the same as the kelps. I think the kelps are kind of the winners in terms of those fast growth rates, but they're slowly moving along, And then they are growing faster than the calcium carbonate containing algae, those pink corallines that are growing along, but they're all kind of moving at their own pace. And
well, it's funny, I keep finding myself, you know, because I'm more familiar with terrestrial stuff, I'm like analogizing things that I'm, like lichens, for example, versus plants or mosses, and, you know, there's lichens that'll actually grow over mosses. They just, like, which... I mean, lichens, you think, oh, they're just like, they seem inert in some way. They don't, you don't tend to look at them as things that are growing fast, but then you'll find them having grown over mosses, and you're like, well, they got to be moving somewhat fast, like expanding. So I don't know if there's similar dynamics happening with overgrowing species.
Well, that's part of the interest. You know, what, one of the things I'm curious about is, as our oceans change, what that's going to do to these different algal communities. And, you know, in general, seaweeds are much like land plants. If we're pumping extra carbon dioxide into the ocean, they're using that to photosynthesize. And so, you know, at a base level, we expect that there's going to be some advantage given to the seaweeds in being able to grow more. Their production is going to increase. There's some complications to that, which I can go into. But in general, the turfs and the algae that don't have calcium carbonate in them are expected to increase in their growth. Mm. And the concern is that all those coral and algae, the algae that have calcium carbonate in their structure, as acidification, ocean acidification becomes more of a thing here, that's actually stealing the carbonate out of their tissue skeleton, and in effect causing them to dissolve away. They're just becoming weaker. And so they've shown in certain areas that those fleshy algae can then start to outcompete. They start to overgrow them. The corallins can't keep up, and you get this totally fleshy dominated system, which you go, well, why does that matter? Well, those corallins are actually, one, they've shown that they send out chemical cues for settlement cues for different larvae. So they actually are a pretty important habitat. And then as they grow and you know, stack up on each other, they create habitat for all these other invertebrates that live underneath them. And if you take that out, you actually start kind of destroying what can live there and dominate in that system. So there's some interest in, you know, are we going to see big macroalgal ecosystem shifts with ocean acidification and with warming and all that?
So that feels like it's kind of at a smaller scale than the forest thing, but sometimes that matters.
Yeah.
And that if they're creating substrate essentially that allows other things to grow in a way that supports the overall kelp forest, that, you know, they may seem small and inconspicuous, I guess, but have an unexpected sort of leverage over the whole system. And is that part of what you're looking at, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I pair all the community surveys that we do with experiments that I actually run in the basement of the Science Center. I rent space from them, and they give me an area to run my mad science experiments. So it's pretty cool. We have a system that we can simulate what we expect Sitka Sound's going to be like at the end of the century. That's the scenario that I'm interested in. And so I have hot tub heaters hooked up to incoming seawater, so I can warm the temperatures by about 7 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what we expect is going to happen. And also I bubble in carbon dioxide gas, just like the oceans are taking up the extra carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. So that simulates ocean acidification. I can then have a bunch of experimental tanks where I grow different things. And for me, that's been algae for the most part. And one of the complexities of figuring out if they're going to respond positively or negatively to those conditions is that algae can actually acquire their carbon dioxide in different ways. So certain species just let that carbon dioxide enter their blade through diffusive processes. Others actually use active transport to take bicarbonate out of the water and bring it into their cells and concentrate it when it's limiting in the environment. And we don't really know which species do what, so there's still a lot of interest in, well, which kelps are going to do really well, which different seaweeds are going to do the best, which ones aren't really going to be affected at all. And that's going to affect the growth. It's also going to affect how they chemically defend themselves against predators. So some algae, like agarum species right now, are really well chemically defended. Urchins do not like eating them. There are areas where I've seen big urchin blooms, and they've taken down all the giant kelp and all the saccharina in one area, and the agarum are just left because they, I think, are really bitter and don't taste very good to the urchins. And we wonder, okay, if we're changing the temperatures and we're changing the amount of carbon that's available to them, is an increased growth rate also going to lead to an ability to continue to chemically defend themselves in the same way, or is that going to affect their chemical defenses? So what does that mean for grazing? What does it mean for nutritional quality to everything else up the food web? Are they going to be as good of a food for everything. Right. So there's a lot of questions about energy flow and how that affects the rest of the food web that I find extremely fascinating. So that's, those are kind of the different pieces I'm looking at. And, you know, what I'm, as someone who eats seaweed, I also am curious about nutritional content and, you know, are the kelp, are the different seaweed species that we like to eat now going to change in terms of how good they are for us?
Yeah.
And what direction is that going to change?
Right.
So
it seems like, there's probably more than a PhD's worth of questions.
Of course. Of course. But like any graduate student, I am totally in over my head.
Right. Just, yeah. Well, that's the fun, right? So you, the reality is that some of those questions end up being easier to answer than others in the time frame in which you have. So you start with a bunch and see which ones sort of filter out as the ones that are actually answerable.
Yes.
And then the rest become longer term research questions, I guess is how that might work. But yeah, I've seen your setup in the, I guess it was a couple summers ago maybe, in down in the basement of the Science Center. And you, it seems like you, it must have been last spring, I think you were telling me that you did an experiment with herring, herring eggs as well, and kelp. Is that, and was that part of what got you sort of interested in this overall question?
Yeah. So I was kind of approaching that interest from my standpoint of wondering what was going to happen to algae and thinking about, well, what are the different services that seaweeds provide here besides food for the food web and habitat? Well, they're also such an important substrate, a nursery ground for herring roe that lay their eggs on them on all different kinds of seaweeds and seagrasses. And so thinking about these beds of kelp and seagrasses in a future ocean, there's been a lot of work that has shown that if you get a big enough bed, you actually get so much drawdown of carbon dioxide in acidified conditions that it creates a little refuge zone from ocean acidification. So my question was, okay, if we have herring roe as eggs in a future ocean that maybe don't do very well in acidified conditions or more warm conditions, would being associated with these algae actually give them some benefit? So could it be a protective habitat for them? And besides just that, what are the impacts of acidification and warming on herring roe? There has not been work done on that.
Yeah.
So that was kind of what, from the algae angle, got me interested in looking at it. And also, obviously, herring are so important to this community and to this region. So that was a really fun study. I got to collaborate with a lot of folks on it. And we took ten mature adults and strip spawn them into these tanks on algae and then also not on algae, and grew them in these future conditions and saw what happened to them. And really interesting, you know, it, as expected, the warmer temperatures that we expect in the future are going to do a lot to affect the larval ecology. They've shown that for a lot of different fish. It shortens the amount of time that they're in their roe phase, so they hatch a lot earlier. They're a lot shorter at hatch. Their nutritional condition is compromised at hatch. Acidification had some effect, but not as significant as warming.
Yeah.
So that kind of seems like it's the big thing. But what really was interesting out of that experiment was, you know, I went out and I got the pieces of kelp that I wanted to put the eggs on and fertilize them on those different blades. And at 24 hours after fertilizing them, the eggs that I put on the kelp blades versus, I actually use silicone baking sheets as my non-kelp substrate, the eggs on the kelp blades had significantly less fertilization success. So they did worse in their fertilization than the ones on silicone. And I went, well, what? That's weird. Like, that's their natural habitat. What's going on there? And then over the course of the experiment, all of the herring eggs that I put on the kelp substrates fell off. They all sloughed off. And so I couldn't use that part of the experiment. I only looked at the effects of acidification and warming on them. But I started asking around, and what did I do wrong? You know, is there something here that I'm missing? And what had happened is that I took those baby blades from the Macrocystis plants and used those in my tanks because they were small enough to fit in my tanks. And it turns out that, one, folks that harvest herring roe a lot said, oh, yeah, anytime we want to pick eggs without kelp on them, we go for the baby blades because they slide right off. No problem. And two, when they are that young, they're probably, again, very well chemically defended. Mm-hmm. So there is probably an interaction with the chemistry of the algal blade and the egg membrane that's being fertilized of a herring egg that probably negatively affected its fertilization success. That's just a theory, but I thought it was really cool that
that's
that,
really
that happened. And so I want to rerun that experiment. We'll see if I get a chance to, but that was cool to think about that. Oh, it probably depends on where they lay their eggs on the, on the kelp.
Well, I mean, are they, I guess I had tended to imagine that they're not really broad. I mean, like they're not laying them on something per se. They're laying them in the water and then they attach. Mm-hmm. And I guess I don't really know the mechanics of it. And if that's what's happening, then I don't know if they would, maybe they attach just fine, but and I don't know where the fertilization happens pre or post attachment, so, or how that's working.
I think the females come in and lay their eggs kind of within those. You'll see them like snaking through the canopy and laying their eggs, and they are so sticky when they
I mean
when we were trying to lay them out on the, they just got everywhere. I mean they're incredibly sticky eggs. And then I believe the males come through and also kind of dance around at the same time and release their milt to fertilize.
I do remember how sticky those were when my son and my kids caught them a few years ago and caught a mess of them, and we decided we were going to I'll wait a second here. Yeah, they decided they wanted to try and eat some. Mm-hmm. And so some of them had roe in them that wasn't, I don't even think it was fully mature, but it was super, I mean, this is like a mess.
Yes.
It was like glue. It was impressively sticky.
Yep.
And I guess it needs to be sticky in the water as well. You know, one of the questions that somebody had mentioned, I think it was Aaron Baldwin, actually, he wondered about, or I heard him mention one time, was just a question about, like, what is the, when you have a massive spawn of herring and there's all those eggs that are metabolizing, they presumably are taking up oxygen.
Yes.
So like that must put a dent in the available oxygen in the water, which is no big deal for the kelp, no doubt.
Right.
But the other critters might not find that so helpful.
Yeah. And they've shown, I mean, that when herring can lay multiple egg layers thick on a single blade, that the bottom egg layers are usually not going to be viable. There's no way they can get enough oxygen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just it's kind of, I mean, I guess it's a short-term thing. Those guys got to hunker down and have trouble breathing for a while.
Yeah.
respirating for...
Got to make it through.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still about a week or two. I mean, it's about 20 days, yeah.
Yeah.
16 to 20 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is there, herring spawn as far south as California, or are they even further than that? But it seems like the spawning time moves up the coast, you know, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine the water south is warmer here. Is there... an analog for sort of looking at how those things are doing in Washington, say, at least for the temperature side of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same issue that you get whenever you try and compare the northern species to the southern species, or even within the species, different types that have accumulated to different temperatures, right? You know, the thermal tolerance is going to be slightly different. So are they plastic in their response enough that they can handle those big swings, or are the stocks up here really not going to be able to handle that? It's interesting. You know, a lot of the questions, even though I, like in my study, even though I can say, okay, I saw them hatch this much earlier and they were this much smaller, and at least looking at a molecular level, they seem like they were compromised nutritionally. I wasn't then able to raise them, to the next life stage. So it could be that they come out, they're smaller, but they just eat a ton more and they do fine.
Yeah.
So you have to piece every life stage together and really to be really able to say, is that affecting their mortality overall? Or is it just, they're compromised at this life stage, but they make up for it at the next one or something like that. And there's a lot of interest in that, in marine ecosystem response to global change in general, because some studies have shown that phytoplankton are expected to do better. You know, certain species are probably going to outcompete others, but there'll probably be much bigger blooms in certain areas. So is that increased food availability actually going to help species that maybe are stressed out in those future conditions to be able to handle it? You know, they suddenly have a bigger food source, and so they're more stressed out, but they can deal with it. So those are kind of the complications of trying to, you know, you can't just look at one species. Yeah. These species are not they're all interacting. They are not living in isolation from one another.
It's all connected.
Yeah.
Well, and I suppose, so, I mean, as you're saying with the herring, that the could be stock differences.
Yep.
I guess I was talking to Ben Burford about that with squid, you know, as they move up here, would they... Could there be selection pressure on to get some adapted to the colder conditions? But I mean the Macrocystis goes. Does it go far south as Baja or so?
Yep.
That's like way warmer than here.
Totally.
I guess I don't know how hard it would be to do transplant studies.
Yeah,
essentially.
Those reciprocal transplants and everything. I think that there's morphological differences for them to handle it. I don't know if they've put one in the back of a truck and drove it all the way up.
Alaska Airlines from
I'm sure people have.
Well, it's an interesting question, I guess. Is it? I mean, obviously with plants, there's ecotypes essentially, and if you move them, then they look normal.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
If you move them to the more normal ecosystem. Or habitat, and so those have sort of a built-in, you know, within an individual, the plasticity that is just, emerges their form emerges out of the interaction of their genetics, I guess, and where they're at, and so something like kelp, you know, I guess I wouldn't know if that's the case, and maybe that isn't currently known, but it's not hard to imagine that it could be that way.
Yeah, totally.
But also that it wouldn't be that way either.
Right. So. And you can certainly see differences, you know, diving in Monterey versus diving in these kelp forests. These kelp forests look pretty pitiful after you've dove in the giant kelp forests of Monterey. They're going to have, you know, 50% more stipes and biomass in the water column than we get here, and it's just they look way healthier. Ours look kind of spindly and small.
So they're kind of at the these guys are. I mean, I guess that's why it's the northern end of the range.
Yeah,
So is it there? I guess so they grow deeper there.
They grow deeper. Yep.
And is that because of light availability with more intense overhead light, or is it of temperature?
I think it's. Well, it gets pretty cold in some of those deeper areas in Monterey as well. So I think it's a lot of it is light. Yeah.
So that wouldn't be expected to change then. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, light and nutrient supply. We get really bottomed out in nutrients here, that's not necessarily true in those different areas. You know, the nutrient dynamics of these kelp beds is really fascinating, and just in the last 10 years have they really started to realize how much they didn't know about nutrient supply, and that it is one of the things I'm looking at here in Sitka Sound is, you know, these, just like land plants, they need nitrogen to grow. Mm-hmm. Where are they getting that nitrogen? And what does that regime look like throughout the year? And I actually sample seawater and I sample an Indian River because one of the things I'm curious about is whether all the decaying salmon in the fall, if all that ammonium and nitrate is actually contributing to the kelp. So anyways, that's part of the dynamics that I'm interested in. What they found in California is that there is way more of the nitrogen that kelp are uptaking throughout the year is coming from the associated invertebrate and fish community through urea. Mm. And that is, they now think that that's like one of the most significant forms of nitrogen, is that you get all the external nitrogen that's coming in from upwelling and oceanic sources, supplies them at some time of the year, but they used to just sample seawater, you know, out from the seabed, and they'd go, oh my gosh, like at this time of year they're getting nothing, how are they continuing to grow? Well, it turns out if you put a fish in a bucket for an hour and measure how much urea it's putting out, which is nitrogen rich compounds, it's a ton. And so, and then, and even the bryozoans that are attached to the kelp blades, they found, are supplying a ton of nitrogen. So all these epiphytes and invertebrates and sea stars they found are huge producers of nitrogen, lobster. So that's kind of the cool thing about when you get into the communities down in Baja and California, you have, it's way more diverse and dense fish communities and vertebrate communities than here. So they're really boosting that nutrient load to the kelp forests and even giving them more to grow with, which is, I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So in here, you mentioned that it really bottoms out. Is that because, I mean, one, there isn't as many of those things and as much, I guess it's not even necessarily diversity, but biomass of those things. And two, that that plankton blooms are so much
more profound here. Exactly. So in the winter, we get the highest nutrients in the water column you're going to see in the winter. Cold winter months, we get a lot of extra wind that's coming through and mixing the water column. And we also get a lot more terrestrial runoff. And there's actually significant amounts of nutrients that are coming off the land that are supplying the kelp. So that's a big part here in Southeast. I don't know how much decaying salmon in the fall. Stay tuned, because some of the isotopic work that I'm doing suggests that it might actually be getting into the kelp and incorporating into the tissues, which I think is pretty neat.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I guess it makes sense that it would. Yeah. Although I don't really know, I don't know how much they talk about the salmon in the trees sort of thing, of the marine stuff going into the terrestrial ecosystem, but how much of the terrestrial system is feeding the marine, especially near shore marine stuff. It is interesting how it's all sort of especially the way that the kelp it makes me think of those little bottles where you can actually have a functioning ecosystem in a bottle.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen those, like that haven't been unplugged they cork them and they haven't been uncorked for decades and they're just growing and they're fine, which is, it's pretty fascinating, because it's just like, I mean, it's not quite the marine equivalent of that, but it did make me kind of wonder about, people that run aquariums that like the big tanks. I don't know how much, it never really occurred to me. I mean, obviously they're putting in food to feed the bigger fish or whatever, but would it be possible to create an aquarium that was self-sustaining in the same way you presumably have to run the water through, but
absolutely. You just have to make sure your nutrients don't get out of balance.
That's really fascinating. So you're just getting sort of started on the bulk of your work then.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of doing things a little bit backwards for various reasons. I've done pretty much the bulk of my field work at this point.
Oh, okay.
We've done community surveys since 2015 here in Sitka Sound. And we also have big environmental sensors that are out there that are recording temperature, pH, dissolved oxygen year-round. And those have been running since 2015. And then most of my experiments that I'm going to use are finished. I have one more this summer that I'm going to grow algae again this summer. And then a few more little projects, but then I'm kind of into the writing.
And into the writing.
And the, the data analysis.
Yeah, Let's not forget that.
but yeah.
So are you going to continue doing the surveys in the meantime?
The lab group that I work with, that project is still slated for another 3 or 4 years. I just had to say, okay, this is the last one I'm going to use. I got to cap it at some point to graduate someday.
That makes sense.
But they're a lot of fun.
It seems like that's, like we were talking about, the long-term thing is just hard to know unless you have data. And so having things like that, I mean, you can kind of do the repeat thing, like, or come back every 10 years or something. And for some, maybe like an alpine habitat where you don't really expect a lot of dynamism. I would imagine that even subtidal stuff can be very dynamic times.
We have four sites. And since 2015, two of our sites have turned into urchin barrens. All the kelp and algae is gone. And the diversity is completely gone down. It's all urchins. And then two of the sites are beautiful and lush. And I can speculate about what caused that. I also think that they probably will come back as kelp beds in the future. So,
well, it is, yeah, it's interesting to know, because, yeah, when you just do 10-year snapshots of a highly variable system, you don't know whether it's a trend or whether it's an accident of you just happen to catch the 2 years of urchin barrens.
Yes, exactly.
If you'd done 2 years later, it would have been back to kelp forest again or whatever. So,
yep.
Yeah, it is kind of, it's an interesting and tricky thing, but it does take resources to continue those projects.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me so grateful to work. I'm so thankful that I'm able to do this work through UC Santa Cruz, but here where I live, because I really appreciate that even though I'm only really doing these community surveys winter, summer, I can still go out in my boat and, you know, peer down at those sites and say, okay, I can observe, you know, kind of this ongoing thing. I'm not just a scientist that comes up, you know, during my field season and takes that snapshot. So I feel like that continuity and talking to other locals who are out and observing things is so valuable to my understanding of really what the reality is.
Yeah. It seems to me that humans are, it's important to have good data and solid data and well constructed data, but we're such incredible integrators of information, mm-hmm. essentially from experience and just seeing it and you know the feel in some ways, like it's not always easy to quantify in a way, but people that spend a lot of time in a place just kind of get a feel for it a little bit, and mm-hmm. it's like, oh, something's changed, you know.
Yeah.
And so I imagine that having the opportunity to kind of spend that time in a place and you know pay attention to it in that way, you develop a better sense of it, essentially, that probably I can't imagine that it that does anything but sort of informs the work that you're doing in a way. Makes it kind of a you know, gives a context for the data that's mm-hmm. that's probably makes it more helpful and contributes more to the actually understanding of what we're really trying to understand.
I do have to be careful as I'm writing my thesis proposal and my advisor's giving me feedback. She does occasionally remind me, okay, I know this is your favorite study system in the world, but make sure you zoom out and say, you know, why is this important that you're studying Sitka Sound to global seaweed communities? Right. And I go, okay.
Yeah.
But I love this system, you know, it's important to this system and these people who live here.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'll
say the academic things. Yeah, the academic thing. It's like, how can other people?
Yeah, we got to sell it to everyone else, Lauren. Yeah. Come on.
Fair enough. Yeah. Well, you know, I realized as we kind of wind down here, there's one question I should have asked you. You're a long time ago, you said you punched holes in these things and watched their growth rates, and like how long does that last for you? Like if you punch one, is it a multiple year hole that
so
you can
follow? So I would actually go back, and every month I would punch a new hole.
Okay.
Yeah, because some of them grow so fast and are simultaneously getting grazed down at the ends.
Well, that's what I kind of wondered is how long a given hole could potentially be
persist.
Observed.
Yeah. So I have a picture looking down one agarum that mm-hmm. was a meter long when I took the picture, I think in July. And I see 5 holes on it.
Oh, wow. So 5
kinda,
months.
Yeah. Kind of neat.
Well, I guess, because again, I don't have any sense of the turnover of an individual, you know, kelp. And it's easy to imagine, just have this weird, like we know in our minds that things grow, but the we see them as snapshots and tend to think of them as static in ways that they really aren't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's fun. So. I've been trying to take pictures every time I go out too, and I have these great before and after pictures. If I ever, at some point I'll put them together and share them, but really neat to see. Even, you know, we were talking before about the morphological diversity in mm-hmm. different species, and it made me realize how dependent that is on at what time of year you catch it, because some of them, when they're growing in the winter, they constrain their growth just to maybe length extension, and then as soon as they get to their maximum growing season, they start to push out in their width as well. And so you capture them at one time of year and they're just these skinny, beautiful little blades, and then you go back a couple months later and they still have that skinny, beautiful blade at the end, and then they have this huge, wide new growth that comes in, and they look like an elephant.
Wow.
And they're, you know, like almost a meter long, but just kind of this hilarious shape.
Wow.
And then eventually that gets grazed and they start to split and they look different. So it's totally dependent, but you wouldn't know unless you...
Yeah.
And so I felt I did that tagging experiment for a year, went back and looked at those same algae individuals at 3 different sites, and I really felt like I knew them. You know, I started that experiment with I laid out a transect and I knew at what meter mark to look for them. And by the end of that year, I didn't need the transect. I just knew exactly where to go to find each of my friends. And I felt like I had followed them, you know, throughout. And when one was gone, whether it got grazed down or taken away, it was kind of a sense of loss. Like, oh, that one left. So it's kind of a fun, intimate journey with different seaweeds.
You don't usually see that in the papers.
No.
But that's
I don't think I'm allowed to wax on about my my intimate relationship with
I appreciate hearing about it, because, I mean, that's for me anyway, that's I like the data and playing with numbers and stuff too, but having those kind of that direct kind of experiential connection with the natural world is I appreciate that. It feels like that's a large part of why we do what we do.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate your time here.
Yeah,
and
thanks for talking to me.
Any place if folks want to kind of follow what you're doing, do you have a place that you'd suggest they check out?
Sure. I've actually started to post a lot of the research that I'm doing on my Instagram. So you can follow me at lobel_AK.
All right.
I also have a Facebook page that's public, as I post a bunch of research that I've been doing. I'm revisiting, as we're in these pandemic times of everyone kind of being stuck at home. I've been taking people on virtual field work with me from my past. So right now I'm kind of replaying some diving work I did under the Landfast ice out of Kaktovik in 2014, and some of the research that we were doing there. Yeah. I've been enjoying sharing my work and getting some neat feedback from that. So if people are interested, that's a place to go.
All right. Well, thanks, Lauren. I'll post those links on my website too when I post the recording.
Great. Thanks.